Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It has been a long, confusing, frustrating, and certainly stressful 3 years with COVID-19. But today, there is a significant change and possibly a renewed sense of hope, even if symbolic for Californians, as the state's emergency declaration expires. Many of the rules, regulations, laws, and things that changed our way of life for the past 3 years are sunsetting. While the state's emergency declaration is officially ending, the fact that remains that COVID is still with us. California has just surpassed 100,000 lives lost to COVID-19, and that's according to state health authorities. So, what now? How do we move forward? What lessons have we learned about medicine, the government's response, and ourselves? Today, we are marking the end of the emergency declaration with a show dedicated to looking forward, but also reflecting on the past. And since the very beginning, there was one voice we consistently sought to help explain both the concerning and hopeful developments with the virus, as well as provide context in a frank but reassuring manner. That person is Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Health. So, Dr. Blumberg, thank you for joining us for the millionth time on Insight and Cap Radio.
I'm happy to be here. I think it's not quite the millionth time.
Yeah, not quite, but still a lot nonetheless. I remember the first time I interviewed you about COVID-19. I was a reporter at KCRA at the time. It was January 27th of 2020. And at that time, there were 5 confirmed cases, 2 of which were in Southern California. Now we're more than 3 years later. California's ending its state of emergency for the pandemic. When you hear those words, what comes to mind that it's coming to a close?
I mean, it's amazing to think back to that January and even February when we were just getting into it, where it was more theoretical and we were just worried about it. And we didn't have any of those restrictions that then came into effect. And even to think about those early days when we had such the severe shutdowns, when everything was virtually closed, people weren't going out at all. We've come such a long way since then. It's almost sometimes traumatic to think about that because it was so difficult for so many people.
Yeah. I mean, the emergency declaration may be ending, but the virus is still very much with us. And for a lot of people, you know, the headline that the emergency declaration is over doesn't mean that it's over for their lives. This also comes as last week, California hit a grim milestone, 100,000 COVID deaths. Did you ever imagine we'd see a death toll that rivals the capacity of the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, which is the largest football stadium in the state?
I never thought we would see so much death, so many hospitalizations that occurred. I thought that with the isolation that we had, that we would do better. And then the vaccines really were developed in record time. So I was really surprised to see the toll that occurred in California.
Given that during all of this, you became one of the voices that we relied on and countless other newsrooms throughout our region for expertise and perspective, I would imagine the requests to interview you were constant and maybe at times relentless, especially during the onset of this pandemic. How has that experience been for you? I mean, you have nearly 40 years of medical experience.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I've always been interested in emerging infectious diseases, whether they're in the pediatric group, which I'm more familiar with, or even in adults. So I did feel in a good place to respond to this, to integrate the emerging information that we had. But it was really busy. You know, at some points, you know, there were 5 or 10 media requests per day. And that was hard to integrate into my professional life, which was obviously busier than usual because of the pandemic. And some of that was related to patient care, that there were increased patient care needs because of COVID. But also we had increased administrative needs because we needed to work on setting policies in place. And so there was a lot of back and forth to make sure that we were providing the best care available and the best environment available for patients. So it was really busy at some points.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about professionally, but how did the past 3 years shape your life outside of medicine?
You know, it was interesting because Personally, I became more efficient, right? Because I think we all
there's only 24 hours in a day, right? That doesn't change.
There's only a certain number of hours in the day. And then in terms of going out during COVID, we all tried to limit like the number of errands we were doing. And so we all, you know, our household, my wife and I, we figured that out, how to be most efficient in terms of doing errands and exposing ourselves less to others. And then in terms of work too, you know, you needed to figure out what's important and what's not. And so to really try to focus in on the things that are important. And then also in terms of social interactions, we all missed that during the social distancing. And then when we returned, you know, like a lot of people, my wife and I returned to socializing really pretty gingerly. It was weird. I remember the first time going out to lunch with friends and not wearing a mask. It was really odd.
So Dr. Blumberg, we're going to take a listen back to almost kind of like chapters of the past 3 years, and mm-hmm. they'll just be a couple sound bites that we're going to share. But we're going to start back to 3 years ago, which was February 27th of 2020. And you were talking to CAP Radio at your hospital, about a patient at your hospital, rather, who at the time was potentially the first community transmitted case of COVID-19 in the country. Here's part of what you told us literally almost 3 years ago to the day.
What this case shows is that the virus is out there, it's in the community, and patients don't have to have those traditional risk factors that we've been relying on for screening patients. It's in the community, and it is transmitted person to person.
What did that moment mean to you? Is that when your worry intensified?
Yeah, I think what that showed was that one patient, diagnosing COVID in one patient with community transmission, that meant that there's probably a lot of undiagnosed patients out there. So there must have been more patients that just weren't tested and had mild disease. They weren't hospitalized. And remember, at the beginning of the pandemic, testing was really limited. For many of our patients, we had to call the public health officer, Dr. Casirier, to get approval for testing because we had such limited capacity. So really, we knew something was going on. We knew that was out there. We knew that there were risks that were out there. And remember, at the beginning, we were screening patients by saying, you know, well, have you traveled to China in the past couple of weeks? Or have you had a contact with a patient who traveled to China in the past couple of weeks? And then we kept expanding the list of countries that we were screening. And, you know, after a while, that becomes nonsensical because it's out there. It's being transmitted in our own communities. And those sorts of screening questions just aren't useful anymore.
Yeah. Now we have, I think, countless experiences, myself included, with my family and friends, when, you know, we didn't know about COVID-19, but then you go back to like January of 2020 and you're like, I got really sick then. And then everyone's mm-hmm. kind of almost like self-diagnosing themselves with hindsight, which is obviously non-scientific. But I think a lot of those anecdotes came to play. You know, when talking about the testing and really the dramatic shortage that we had with testing at the very beginning, you joined Insight again just 11 days later from that last soundbite that we played, and you talked about the challenges of testing. So let's take a listen back.
We've been just in the dark trying to find out how far this virus has penetrated in the community. And with the very limited testing that's been done, we really haven't been able to describe the landscape. And what we've really heard in terms of the cases is really the tip of the iceberg.
What were some of the lessons that you and other medical professionals have learned about what could be done better if or when there's another pandemic?
I think I'm hopeful that we all appreciate the role that public health plays in all of our lives, that it's not just a theoretical issue, but we really need to support the public health infrastructure in the country, in the state, in our county. We really need public health, and that's important for our own personal health. And so if we had more support for public health, we might have had these tests available sooner, and we might have been able to ramp up production and had wider availability of these tests. And that would give us a better idea of how much community transmission there was and really what steps needed to be taken next.
Yeah. And that support obviously includes funding as well. At what mm-hmm. points were you maybe the most frustrated during the course of the pandemic of not being able, you and your colleagues, to accomplish what you needed to be done just due to factors outside of your control?
I think one of the issues that we just didn't know enough about was the protection that was provided by masks. And, you know, we had an idea that masks probably would work in a community setting, but we didn't have the data to prove that. We weren't sure if masks were going to be in short supply, so if we should be recommending them for the public or if they should be reserved for the healthcare environment. And, you know, I remember this one moment when I went in to see a baby who had COVID, a newborn who had COVID. And at that time, we weren't masking unless there was an aerosol producing procedure in place, because we thought it was mostly transmitted via aerosol, so that there was low risk. I remember being unmasked in this room with this baby, and this baby crying and thinking, you know, those are pretty vigorous, good cries. And looking at the nurse next to me, and we're both not wearing masks, thinking, there's got to be COVID coming out when this kid is crying and breathing, and we're just standing there without masks on. This doesn't seem right. And we weren't an outlier. This was very early in the pandemic, where really we weren't doing the regular masking or the N95 masking for, you know, for patients, and unless there was an aerosol producing procedure. So that got changed, you know, and we did end up doing the N95 masks, and, you know, even around, casually around patients, which just makes so much more sense. But we just didn't know back then.
Yeah. And medical staff at that time, nurses included, I mean, there wasn't enough PPP to even go around at the beginning of the pandemic as well.
Right. You know, people were affected in their personal lives, that, you know, we had that, like, the toilet paper shortage, right. You know, that, and then in the hospital we were trying to figure out ways, how can we extend mask usage? Because we were, sometimes many hospitals were teetering on the edge of running out of masks, and the supply chain was affected. And so there was a lot of work going into, you know, can you extend mask use between patients? Can you, what about the N95s? Can we, like, reuse them? Can we re-sterilize those? You know, what can we do to extend the supply?
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Health, reflecting on the past 3 years of the pandemic as California lifts its state of emergency. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.